Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's cool fact of the day is about ketosis. Did you know that your alcohol tolerance is severely lowered while you're in ketosis? There are a couple reasons for that. The first is that the alcohol you drink when you're in ketosis will get metabolized immediately before your body keeps burning ketones for energy. And the carbs in your system that are normally used to, quote, soak up alcohol in the stomach and slow down the intoxication process probably won't be there if you are drinking while you're in ketosis. Not to mention, it's difficult to stay in ketosis while you're drinking. So you got to ask yourself, you know, is it really worth it to have a beer, which is going to take you out of ketosis, or red wine, which is going to take you out of ketosis, or vodka, which may or may not take you out? I don't really think it's worth it. You don't get a lot of performance benefits from those things, but they can be fun. There are lots of other ways to have fun, though, too, as well.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
So I'm excited, and we're going to talk about how to go even deeper in today's show with ketosis, because our guest is Dr. Richard Veach, who's a senior researcher and laboratory chief at the National Institutes of Health and winner of the NIH Director's Award, which is very prestigious. He's been working to understand the mechanisms behind cellular energy homeostasis for the last 47 years. He's got 2 degrees, a doctorate of medicine from a little university you may have heard of called Harvard, and is the foremost researcher of an expert of all things ketone esters. Dr. Veach, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, what did you do before you became a medical doctor? What did you study as in your undergrad that maybe give you a different perspective compared to the average just doctor?
Well, as an undergraduate at the university, I studied history and literature, which was a very interesting department. It was founded by a chemist, Charles Y. Eliot, who decided that everyone that was educated need to have knowledge of the Bible, Shakespeare, Greek history, Greek tragedy, Russian novel, and a foreign language. So you had three hour oral exams. It was very good. very good undergraduate education.
So you started out with something that isn't traditional for someone who went to medical school, and you also along the way got a PhD in as a research biochemist as well, right?
That's right. Yes, I did that after I was my residency in medicine.
There are very few physicians who also study biochemistry at that level. Why did you decide to do that? I mean, that's I don't say almost unheard of, but it's so rare, and it gives you such a different perspective on things. What made you go to that level of effort?
Well, if you've been an intern and resident and you've seen a few people die, you realize that you really don't know very much at all, and you better go learn some more. So that's what I did, and I looked at a bunch of different labs, and I ended up going to a lab that I thought was the best in the world, and I think that was right. It was at Oxford, and I studied with Sir Hans Krebs, and he is, I think, still the best biochemist of this century. And so that's where I learned my biochemistry.
And for people listening, this is none other than the guy who discovered the Krebs cycle, which is why it's named after him, right? This is the core of how our cells make energy via ATP. In my own losing of 100 pounds and getting my brain back, I read all of Krebs' things and everything I could about the citric acid cycle to find ways to make it work better. And wow, if you fix your mitochondria and improve their performance, even a small percentage, it just pays dividends everywhere in your body. And that's why I was amazed. Like, you actually studied with the man.
Well, the essence of what we're saying and how ketones work is precisely in the Krebs cycle. In many, many diseases, for instance, you're to be congratulated for losing 100 pounds. But people that are overweight have an impaired Krebs cycle. They have an impairment in their pyruvate dehydrogenase, and it just doesn't work very well. Now, ketones bypass that block at PDH. And so all the things we're saying about ketosis are applicable to type 2 diabetes. They're applicable to injury, to infection, and even a number of diseases. For instance, Alzheimer's disease is a block in PDH in the brain. And so it's a central gateway into the Krebs cycle, but it's very easily disturbed. And when it's disturbed, you can get around that disturbance by giving ketones. And so one other thing I'd say is ketones, doctors tended to fear. Ketones were discovered in Germany in the 1880s. And people were afraid of them because they knew about diabetic ketoacidosis. On the other hand, a man named George Cahill, who was professor of medicine at Harvard, showed that the brain, the only substance that the brain could use to produce energy aside from glucose was ketones. And he further showed that really ketones occur normally when you starve. So if I starve you for 5 days, your ketones go up to 7 millimolar. And this allows you to live. Man is the only animal that gets ketosis normally. And that's because you've got this very huge brain that you've got to support. And if you had to support on glucose, you'd be dead in 6 days. As it is, a normal weight man can live 76 days. An obese man can live almost indefinitely. So that's really the substance of ketosis. There's nothing dangerous about it. It's the normal state of man. Before we had McDonald's on every corner, we fasted in between the time we were chasing the mammoth and we caught the mammoth. In order to do that, you needed to be ketotic. And that's why we have ketosis.
Now, when you say there's nothing dangerous about ketosis, I wonder. I know many people who can go in ketosis, and they stay there for years, and they're happy as clams. When I tried an experiment of extreme low carbs, like one serving of vegetables a day, the rest fat and some protein, trying to kind of mimic an Inuit-style diet, I didn't do so well. I ended up in my book recommending cyclical ketosis, where you go into ketosis, you come out, you go in, you come out, rather than constantly being in heavy ketosis. Do you think there are risks to being in ketosis for long periods of time, or is it something that just works for most people, and I'm an exception on that one?
No, some Canadians, the name of whom I can't remember right now, studied the Inuit diet, and they ate just nothing but fat and meat, nothing but fat and meat, and they felt really sick and didn't do very well.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened to me.
They couldn't figure out what it was. Well, it turns out when you go up and look at the Inuits, they drink the broth, so they're eating a large amount of salt, and so they can get away with it. But if you do what you think the Inuits are doing, which they didn't do, you don't do very well. You feel sick.
Yeah.
I can't remember the man's name.
I think I read that too. And there's also the so-called animal starch, collagen, which functions in the gut as a fermentable substrate for bacteria to make short-chain saturated fats.
Yeah.
And I think I at the time I wasn't using my collagen, and I wasn't making bone broth. And the Inuits were definitely boiling whale bones and doing all the other crazy stuff. Right. So I think I made some mistakes there. But the core thing there, even if we're not going quite to the Inuit side of things, I've talked to Dominic D'Agostino, who I have great respect for, and many of the other researchers in this field. So I was an early ketone advocate. And I still don't know the answer. I realize that to reach the maximum number of people, going in and out of ketosis seemed to be the broadest thing to provide benefits. But I still don't have, from any expert, everyone should go in ketosis and stay there most of the time or not, or it's safe for everyone to do it, but it's up to them. What's your take? I mean, you have more experience in this than almost anyone I've met.
Well, it depends how you do ketosis. Okay. If you're doing it with a very, very high fat diet, people can't do it very long because it's so unpalatable. They can't stand it, or they get nauseous, or they get diarrhea. So that's one way. If you're just starving and eating water and whatnot, there's no problem with it. And in fact, you're very hungry for the first 4 or 5 days. After about 5 days, you're no longer hungry.
I know that when I'm doing a normal high-fat diet, that hunger thing, the induction period again in ketosis that Atkins, I think, first popularized, it makes you feel, they call it like the flu, you feel really crappy. And what I've been doing for the past 10 years or so is kind of short-circuiting that, because I finally found the research that I think explains it, that when you have a level of just 0.5, a pretty far cry from 7 millimolar, your CCK and your ghrelin, these are your hormones for fulfillment and for feeling full, and your craving hormone, your hunger hormone, they get shifted by just a small amount of ketone. You're not quite in nutritional ketosis, but you're way higher than normal. And all of a sudden, all the carb flu things that I was used to having, where I just feel crappy, they just went away because my hunger, like I wasn't craving, I wasn't hungry. I didn't care about food the first day I did it. And that comes from putting brain octane, which goes to BHB, which then goes to ketones, in bulletproof coffee. So there's no carbs, and there's something that just gave me a little bump of ketones, not a big bump. And that seemed to help. But what you're talking about is getting huge bumps of ketones, because we know there are three kinds of ketones that are used differently in the body. Can you go into more about the different kinds of ketones and that hunger suppression thing?
Well, suppression of hunger really is a function of beta-hydroxybutyrate. Acetoacetate doesn't work very well. And the third thing that's called a ketone is acetone, and it really shouldn't be called a ketone. It's very small in amount, and it has a completely different metabolic pathway. So you've got two major forms of ketones, ketone bodies. One is called beta-hydroxybutyrate, and one is called acetoacetate. Now, if you eat a lot of acetoacetate, it can be metabolized, but it doesn't have the energy that beta-hydroxybutyrate.
How would I go about eating acetoacetate?
Well, you can buy it. There are people that make esters with it.
Okay.
And I don't recommend it.
Okay.
Reason is Krebs in the late 1960s showed that you could take a heart that wasn't working and perfuse it with acetoacetate and did just fine. If you did a working heart and you perfused with acetoacetate, it failed immediately, instantly. And so, but if you fed it beta-hydroxybutyrate, it pumped normally. And that's what we did in the Sato paper. Now, the reason is it's going in the mitochondria. And when the ketone body goes in the mitochondria and you're giving it acetoacetate, the I have to get a little technical. Okay. The NAD couple gets oxidized. And so you, with beta hydroxybutyrate, it gets reduced. And the remarkable thing about metabolizing beta hydroxybutyrate is you reduce the NAD, but you oxidize the next step up, the Q. And so you've increased the redox span between NADH and Q, and that determines the energy of ATP. So this is why you get more energy. It's why the heart gets 38% more energy when it's metabolizing ketone bodies than it is when it's metabolizing glucose. And I told a very famous biochemist named Henry Lardy, who ran the Enzyme Institute at the University of Wisconsin. I said, "Dr. Lardy, I've increased the energy of the heart by 38%. I said, he said, "I don't believe you." I said, "Well, all right, what number do you want me to change?" There's just pressure and volume, and that's joules. Then he looked back at his own work. He was involved in preserving bull sperm for the dairy industry, and he found that beta-hydroxybutyrate was the best substrate he came across. He couldn't understand why. Well, now I'm telling you why that happens.
It's because mitochondria love that stuff, and sperm are incredibly, incredibly high in mitochondria because they have to swim or they don't survive.
Have to swim. That's right. And if you're trying to impregnate a cow, it's very important that you have healthy sperm. So the dairy industry was very happy. Lardy didn't he had a question in his notebook. He showed me, why does this happen? He never went into it, but I just told you the reason that it happened.
So what I've discovered in my own life is I take a precursor to BHB, that's brain octane, and I've never heard the 38% number before, but I feel it's such a huge performance upgrade because the place with more mitochondrial density than the cardiac system is the prefrontal cortex. And I actually found studies of mitochondrial density. They're actually hard to find. And I did a ton of this when I was writing my Bulletproof Diet book to explain, why do I feel like I got my brain back when I do this versus why I don't? And I think you just named a number that I didn't have in my research, which was kind of annoying. But 38% better from having BHB present versus having just glucose present.
That's correct.
Okay.
MCTs are mid-chain triglycerides, and they do 10% of that fat goes directly into the mitochondria and is directly converted to ketone. By 90% is metabolized by beta oxidation.
So doesn't that depend on which MCT it is? Because lauric acid, lauric acid doesn't work at all, which is the most common MCT.
The eight is the maximum to get the maximum ketone body production.
That's what's in brain octane. All it is eight. I take away the 10 and 12 and 6. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, people like Mary Newport recommend the C12 because it tastes good. Coconut oil tastes good.
Yep.
From a biochemical point of view, we don't care if it tastes good or not.
It's true. And there's no flavor to C8 when it's properly distilled. You can't taste anything. It's a flavor enhancer, but by itself, it's even less than like a canola oil in terms of flavor. But I would eat it if it tasted like, you know, rat liver. It doesn't matter because you feel different. And that's my whole ethos. I'd eat a bowl of gravel for breakfast if that's what made me feel like this. But what you've done, though, is in 47 years of research, you've also worked with some other guys like Dr. George Cahill, who's one of the main things. Can you tell me some of the stories about Dr. George Cahill and your work with him in discovering all these things?
Well, George Cahill, really, this work all comes from George Cahill because he, as I told you, was the first man to show that the brain could use ketones. Before that, before his time, it was thought it could only use glucose. He showed that it could use ketones. Now, he then was a good friend of Krebs and was at a meeting in Indianapolis. And he asked Krebs what the redox state of the NADP system was. And no one knew. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to Oxford, Krebs called me in and said, that's your project. Tell me what the NADP, NADP, the free ratio of NADP, NADPH is, because that's involved in all fat synthesis and reducing free radicals. So I worked for a year and finally got the answer I wanted, and I showed it to Krebs, and He said, well, that can't be right. I said, well, it is right. He didn't say anything. But about 2 weeks, he thought about it for 2 weeks, and he came back and he started writing. And that was the longest paper he ever wrote. And that paper shows the relationship between the redox states of the three great nucleotides and how they're related to ATP. Because the energy of ATP is derived as redox energy. And so another fact that ketones do, and aside from increasing the energy of ATP, is they increase the reducing power of the NADP system. So if you have increased free radicals, say in Parkinson's disease, mm-hmm. or amyotrophic atherosclerosis, or in a nuclear bomb, this will protect you from that radiation. And that's a major effect. The only third major effect of ketones is their ability to decrease inflammatory reactions, which is a different mechanism.
Oh, the anti-inflammatory effects of ketones, I learned about those in a paper just a little while ago and was blown away. But the anti-radiation effects, I had no idea. Does this protect you from all forms of radiation?
Yeah, what you call ionizing radiation, yes.
Whoa, so basically around Fukushima, we should be dosing everyone with anything that raises ketones. Oh my God. Okay. The Bulletproof Diet, well, I just sold 100,000 copies of the Bulletproof Diet in Japan without trying. And I'm so thankful you said that, because when I go to Japan to talk about this, I can talk about this because no one's offered any kind of protection for ionizing radiation. Dr. Beach.
the Tokyo Power Company, I actually am a good friend, okay. a Japanese scientist, and they really weren't that interested in it.
Oh, wow.
I don't think quite oil. But what I was interested in it was the question of nuclear terrorism.
Okay.
It seems very likely sooner or later that we're going to have a rogue nuclear bomb sitting in Lafayette Park across from the White House. And we have nothing to protect our policemen or if you're within a mile of a 10 megaton bomb, you're dead.
Yeah,
you're just frozen. You're ashes.
Right.
But now it's in this area outside of that where you're getting the fallout that you'll make a difference. And so I'm very interested that this be used for radiation protection, but then be stockpiled.
I'm blown away. My grandparents met on the Manhattan Project in Chicago.
Oh, really?
And they moved to Los Alamos. My grandmother's a nuclear engineer. My grandfather's a PhD a PhD physical chemist. And I have never, and I'm like a ketone guy. I've never heard this before, Dr. Veach. you're blowing me out of the water here. This is so cool.
Well, there's more correlations than that. Cahill's wife was the daughter of Crawford Greenwell. And Crawford Greenwell was the CEO of DuPont. And he's the one that built the plant at Hanford. Mm-hmm. And so all of our ability to produce nuclear bombs in the Second World War came from Crawford Greenwell. He wrote the definitive book on the hummingbird. He ran DuPont. He did that in the morning before he went to become CEO to run DuPont. Britton Chance and I went up to visit his lab. They named a lab for him in Wilmington. And all he wanted to talk about was Alzheimer's disease, because his wife had Alzheimer's disease. Now that was, I can say this now because they're both dead. Cahill's wife was the granddaughter of Crawford Greenwell, and she subsequently died of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
And, of course, he was important in Manhattan Project. Very.
Very.
And I'm sure he would have been not surprised at all. He was a very, very smart man.
Wow.
To say the least.
The connections there go so far back. That lab at Hanford used a process, I think it was called the Permutex. That process for separating plutonium is what my grandfather invented.
Is that right?
It's still used today. Well, oh my God. Permex, I'm forgetting its name. But
if that book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, the first five chapters are the best thing that's ever been written on the development of physics in that age. And the people that were involved in that Krebs was also a big friend of Niels Bohr.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
I didn't realize that the physics guys were as connected with the biochemistry guys back then, because our bodies are biophysical, right?
Absolutely. And Krebs, Bohr, as you know, did quantum mechanics, and he talked to Heisinger, who the Germans wanted to have make a nuclear bomb, and he said it would be immoral for physics to be turned to such purposes.
Yeah.
Within 3 days, he was on a boat going to Sweden. And then the British put him in a bomb bay of a bomber and flew him to England, where Krebs met him, and the oxygen tube came loose, and Krebs thought they'd gorked him. They thought, here's this brain, and we just destroyed it.
Oh, no.
But it didn't. He came back, and they were friends, really, for the rest of their lives, and both of them received the German Pour le Mérite. Now, Krebs and Bohr were the only ones that opposed taking Germany and turning it into a pasture. The Americans wanted to say, listen, these terrible Nazis need to be destroyed, and all their industry goes. And Krebs, whose father was killed by the Germans because he was a Jew, on the other hand, his mother, his stepmother, lived for 5 years in Germany, was hidden by a German citizen. So he didn't feel this way. Not all Germans were raving Nazis. And he and Bohr are the ones that prevented Germany from being essentially agriculturalized, destroy all their science, destroy all their industry. And he had a lot of flack from that, but it was clearly the moral thing to do. I mean, he was, after World War II, what Lincoln was to the Civil War. You could have destroyed all the Southerners, but the better course would be to reconcile them. And so it wasn't just his science. It was his morals.
He was a humanitarian as well. Wow, these are things I did not know, and I'm fascinated to learn this. You've also done some work with General Petraeus around traumatic brain injury. You have a pretty amazing history here. Tell me about that.
Well, my son is a physician at the VA, and he went to a meeting at the VA to hear about traumatic brain injury, because at the time about 60% of our casualties were due to IEDs. Mm-hmm. And he gave me the notes from the meeting, and it was just nonsense. It was just garbage. It was a whole bunch of people standing around trying to get money from the Army, and they had nothing to do except getting money. And it was just,
yeah.
And this annoyed me, because Petraeus, he's a PhD from Princeton, and he sat through, in the middle of the Afghan war, he sat through this whole meeting of nonsense. And so I said, well, that's just intolerable. So I wrote a paper on what the causes, how you diagnose and how you treat it. And I sent it to him. And he, at that time, had left the Army and was head of CIA. And I got a letter, a very kind letter back from him. Because Petraeus was shot in the chest at Fort in Kentucky, and the surgeon that operated on him was trained by George Cahill. And so I got a letter back from the said director of CIA, and the stamp on it said love. Which I thought was very amusing, a love stamp from the director of the CIA. I'm sorry he left, because another friend of mine, Dr. Newport.
Mary Newport?
Yeah.
She's been a guest on the show too. Tell me about her.
Yeah, we were at the Cosmos Club, and I saw General Petraeus at another table. So I took Dr. Newport over and introduced him. And he said, we've made a lot of progress with traumatic brain injury. And I said, General, you've made no progress whatsoever. And I had my tie clip on, which is an Oxford tie clip. And he looked at that and he said, where's that from? I said, that's Oxford. And he said, well, not everyone can go to Princeton.
Oh, what a great guy. That's hilarious.
Yeah, he really is very, very, very bright. And he understood what I was saying. And But that's the reason I wrote that paper. DARPA, the whole reason we got money to do the ketones came from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration. NIH would never has given money for this kind of metabolic research. But DARPA wanted it because they wanted to improve the performance of their special forces.
Yeah.
And I read this stuff, and I went to see the man that wrote it, and I said, well, I don't know, Dr. Blitzky, I don't know who wrote this, but whoever did is full of crap. And he started laughing. And he said, I wrote it. I said, well, not totally full of crap, just half full. And he said, all right, what would you do? So I wrote him a 3-page thing and said what I would do, and he gave me $10 million.
Wow.
That's a good scientist, because most scientists get bent out of shape when you're telling them full of stuff. He didn't. And we learned in that when a colleague, Dr. Clark, who's in Oxford, found that not only could the rats run more efficiently on a treadmill, but their maze performance increased. So we were able to improve the mental capacity, the mental functioning, mm-hmm. the maze performance of these rats. Now, she's also studied Olympic athletes, and they can row faster, longer. Ketones don't do anything for sprint performance. If you're running the 100-yard dash, it's not going to do anything. If you're doing the 440 or better, it's going to help you. And the same's, well, since it's a mitochondrial substrate, it doesn't work for sprints. Any biochemist knows that, but it will work for bicycling or rowing or those long distance endurance sports.
There are certainly a lot of triathletes who use the bulletproof coffee idea, which is a way of getting some ketones in, because you feel a difference. I'm not an endurance athlete. I don't even think endurance athletics is particularly good for you. I'm planning to hit 180 if I'm lucky, not miles an hour. That's years. And so I'm kind of careful on mitochondria, but I do see that in every day there's a certain amount of endurance that's involved if you're going to operate at your maximum capacity. It seems like a noticeable difference to me.
You know, and if you just look at the general question of aging, which is what you're talking about. The cardinal theory in the generation of aging is free radical damage.
Yeah.
This has been known. And I just told you that ketone bodies abolish a large part of the free radical damage.
Yes.
And not only would that work in aging, but that would work if you happen to be next to Fukushima. It's the same process. It also lowers the cholesterol. It decreases the blood sugar, and it increases your histone deacetylase. It decreases the inflammatory reaction. So many of the hallmarks of the aging process are addressed by ketosis.
There's something a little bit scary about that, though. There are studies that show for things like exercise, if you take antioxidants, specifically like vitamin C, vitamin E, the traditional orthomolecular antioxidants, that you don't put on muscle. Like the damage, the short burst of pro-oxidant activity that comes from exercise causes a response in the cells where they generate more SOD and more glutathione and things like that. That if you suppress that, you don't get the muscle growth, you don't get the repair. Do ketones do the same thing as these other compounds?
Well, first let me address the question of taking antioxidants. Mm-hmm. The ingestion of antioxidants like vitamin C, if you remember, Linus Pauling was a big exponent of this.
Yes.
Krebs wrote him several letters about this. And finally, I saw the last letter he wrote, and he said to Dr. Pauling, please quit writing about that which you do not understand.
Really? This is fascinating.
And the reason... you can't change the redox state by feeding antioxidants. There's a whole lot of people that eat Q. All you're doing is increasing the total pool of Q. You want to change the ratio of Q to oxidized Q. The redox state of ascorbic acid is controlled by the NADP system. So the only way you can control the redox state, the only way I know, is with ketosis. You must, or with glucagon, you must reduce the NADP system. All these other reducing agents are nonsense.
I have a couple other compounds that are shown to change the NAD plus to NADH ratio in a favorable way. And two of them are in my core products. There's upgraded aging, which is oxaloacetate. And the other one is a unique form of PQQ. These are interesting in that they're messing with basically ratios within the Krebs cycle, but they're not classical antioxidants like vitamin C.
Oh, the problem, if I can say so.
Yeah, I'm very interested.
As oxaloacetate is it's a but dicarboxylate, and it's hard to get inside the cell.
Okay,
there are very few dicarboxylates that get in there. Now, the virtue of ketones is they're monocarboxylates.
They go in real easy.
They go in real easy. Now, in Q, I just already addressed that issue, and that is, by increasing the pool of Q, you needn't change the ratio of oxidized to reduce Q. You merely increase the total amount of Q. Now that, for an energetic point of view, let's say you're trying to increase the delta G of ATP. You've got to oxidize the Q and reduce the NAD couple. And that gives you a greater, that's all done in the Sato paper, which I'm sure you've read, or if you look at it again.
I'll look at it again. I don't remember that.
Well, it's got little pictures. They were done by my colleague, Dr. Kashiwaya.
Okay.
And his pictures are much better than all my blather.
Well, I'll put those pictures, or at least a link to the paper, in the transcription of this interview. Can you explain for people listening, a lot of them are driving their cars right now and they're not biochemists, what is Q in the way you're talking about it here?
Q is the mitochondria is simply a redox motor. So it starts with the lowest redox state cofactor, it's called, which is a vitamin. It's called NAD.
Yes.
So the electrons are accepted. All you are is a fuel cell. So you're taking electrons from the substrate you're eating and combining them with water to make energy. That's what you do. Now, the first step in that transformation of energy is going from NAD to Q. And so the redox distance between those two couples is what determines the delta G of ATP. So you want to widen that distance. Now, if you're eating fats, say like a Atkins diet, you reduce NAD, which is good. You're reducing that, producing more NADH to NAD ratio. But you're also reducing Q. So that doesn't give you that increased span. You've decreased the span, and therefore your energy is lessened. So the magic of ketones is it reduces the first one while it oxidizes the second one. I don't know anything else that does that.
In my entire 20 years of trying to get my brain back and working on losing weight and all, I've never found anything more important than ketones either. And I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on my own my own system, and I've found things that move the needle. But this is like a 2%, a 5%, or like now I know the number, a 38%. Like,
well, don't feel bad. I've wasted 30 years doing this. Don't feel bad.
I don't feel bad. I feel fortunate because I used to have all kinds of problems that I've largely resolved. I don't think I started out biologically that strong, but I'm better now at 43 than I was at 23, and that's not
right.
Normal. But you've done something else that I really wanted to zoom in on, and something that I've never talked about this before, but 3 years ago, I did pay to have a ketone ester synthesized. And it was shockingly expensive, and I got one tiny little vial of it, and I said, this is really neat. I have no idea what it's going to do to my liver. Like, I'm going to take it. But there was no conceivable way I could think of to sell that stuff because I didn't know I could make it affordable. So this was one of those, it's a really neat idea, but it's not doable. And here it is 3 years later, I find out you've been doing all kinds of cool stuff with ketone esters. And can you talk about what is a ketone ester versus the way that I generate ketones now? Like, what is it? What's going on with that stuff?
Well, ketone bodies are an acid. They're beta hydroxybutyric acid. So if you're fasting during the day, you make 150 grams of ketone body. That means if I gave it to you as the acid, I'd be giving you 150 moles of acid. Well, that's a little bit too much.
Yep.
Now, if I gave it to you as a sodium salt, I'd be giving you 150 grams of sodium. Now, your cardiologist would shoot me. You're allowed to have, you'd have 3 grams. So I need to give you 150 grams. So the only thing you can do is give you a beta hydroxybutyrate with a compound called 1,3-butanediol of the proper isomeric structure, mm-hmm. the R form, and join the two together where they hydrolyze it in the body. And so you can get by without either giving you excess acid load or increased salt load. And that's what we've done. Now, the next question is how to make that cheaply.
That was the problem. The stuff was like $30,000 a pound the way I was making it.
I know that. And that you can't go to the drug companies. They're used to making a pill. You really must go to the agricultural producers. This is a food, and so you must produce it. Not only can you not go to Korea or Japan or India to buy the precursors because you don't know what you're getting. Mm-hmm. And if you remember the story of tryptophan,
yes,
with eosinophilic myalgia, MIT killed 47 people with that stuff. So you really cannot use that. But if you start with glucose or corn or sugarcane, you know what you're starting with and you know what you're going to get out. And you also have the capacity to supply, let's say you want to supply 5 million Alzheimer's patients. You would break the government. You must get the price down.
Yep.
Way, way, way down. And the only way you can do this is with the tank car quantities. This is not a pharmaceutical.
That's exactly my point with the brain octane. I want to put that stuff out there. Anything I can do to get it more affordable because it's the most important thing I know. But you're telling me there may be another way to do this, which is why I'm super excited. How do I get tanker cars of ketone esters? Are we that close?
Yes. Okay. We know how to do it. There are men that know how to do it. I mean, they're chemical engineers. Okay. I'm not a chemical engineer, but they make tank car loads of this stuff. Right now they're making ethanol, which is worthless.
Yeah, a waste of corn.
That's right. They're making high fructose corn syrup, which is just makes people obese.
So we could turn that same corn that we're basically destroying our soil to make corn. We could take that corn and instead of turning it into diabetes,
you could make ketone esters.
So now, for people listening to this right now, if you understand the implications of what we're talking about, you should be pissed off.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yes, but businessmen are mainly motivated by profit, and they're also extremely cautious. And when you tell them something new, the ketone body, the delta G of ATP, they have no idea what you're talking about. Absolutely none. Well, they just don't know. And so eventually, this is going to have to be done because the government can't afford. It costs $80,000 a year to keep an Alzheimer's patient in diapers. And the government can't afford that. Even the government can't afford this. So we're going to have to do this.
Well, the interview with Mary Newport on Bulletproof Radio, I think she was number 47, if I remember. Like, we're at around 300, so this is a little while ago. She was just talking straight up, you know, how she worked with her husband. And either you have it or you go on a ketosis diet, you increase ketones in the body however you need to, and then you don't have the symptoms of Alzheimer's. My grandmother, who works on the Manhattan Project, she's 94. And if I can get ketones into her body, and she uses the brain octane stuff, she watches calculus videos on YouTube for fun. Like, that's awesome. And then when she doesn't have that stuff, she kind of like, you know, she's just not herself. And she kind of, you know, sits at the retirement community and doesn't do what she would normally do. And I value that. I think it's important. And
absolutely.
Okay.
No, Dr. Newport's right. I mean, this guy couldn't live without it. When he, you know, he could go about, well, she's written about it in the paper. And so you improve his behavior. The same is true with Parkinson's. And Parkinson's, it's easier to see because a Parkinsonian, many of them have just terrible tremors.
Right.
well, these tremors go away.
Wow, so ketones turn off the tremors in Parkinson's.
That's correct.
They turn off a lot of the brain deactivation in Alzheimer's, you're saying?
Yes, yes.
What about ALS? I have a good friend.
We would like to treat that. The problem with that, it's like Parkinson's. It's a free radical caused disease. But if you start treating an ALS patient and he gets better, let's say you get him off his oxygen tube, you can't stop. We could make enough ketone ester to treat Mary Newport's husband, one patient, unless we get industrial collaboration.
Yeah.
So there's no way we can start ALS until I've got a firm supply, because you can't go back and say, well, Mr. Jones, you did a lot better. We're going to put your trach tube back in.
Yeah, they're not going to go for that. And one of the things that is, there are correlations with all these, especially ALS, is neurotoxin exposure that is mitochondrial poison.
Yes.
These are environmental things made by Mother Nature or made by us, but they inhibit mitochondrial respiration, and then people get sick. And they're fat-soluble toxins, and they mostly come from either algae or toxic mold. And I know in my case, a lot of my symptoms, I grew up in a basement with Stachybotrys, which inhibits mitochondrial respiration. And like, okay, so I did a documentary about the dangers of water-damaged buildings, and I see correlations all the time, and with ALS, very specifically the algae-derived toxins. But if you can fix mitochondria by using ketones instead of using glucose, you bypass the damaged part of them. And when I go out of ketosis, when I stop using brain octane, I don't have at least 0.5 in my blood, my brain doesn't work the way it does now. So every single day I do bulletproof coffee. Every single day I do, you know, not too much sugar, because I lose my ability to function the way I do now. And I'm not going to go back to that, but I think I have some maybe permanent damage to my mitochondria from toxin exposure. And I think our friends with ALS are dealing with something similar. I don't know.
Yeah, I just, for the reasons I said, we haven't even approached
you haven't
that.
Even got
you
can't, on it.
Well, I mean, I'd love to do it, but until we have a couple of tons in the back room, I can't do it.
Well, maybe there's a way to help. If I can, I will, and we can talk about that after the show. But this is important to not even just like the country's future, but like the whole world. Like we have so many people who are aging that this isn't a problem we can ignore, and I don't think it's a problem the drug companies can solve, because if they try and solve it with drugs, no one can afford it. It's got to be a food-based thing, and it looks like you've got something pretty special here. And let's talk about it a little bit more. What about ketone salts? I mean, there's companies making ketone salts. We talked a little bit about how you'd have to have huge amounts of sodium, but you can get magnesium and potassium and things like that. What happens if you try and use ketone salts to maintain ketosis?
Well, if you can't give that much magnesium, and so you end up
disaster pants.
You get too much salt in. You calcium and potassium. Oh, potassium will kill you. So you're really left with sodium. And the advantage of ketone salts is they have a very good taste. The problem is you can't get adequate levels. The KM to get in the brain is 5 millimolar. You'd be lucky to get 0.1 with the ketone salts. And furthermore, the ketone salts that are being sold are racemic mixtures. They're not, the only ketone that's effective is the D form. The DL is completely different. It metabolized in beta oxidation. And so it's actually harmful. And so, you can't, and it's done for convenience of manufacturing. You know, it's cheaper to use the racemic salt. Well, fine, but the effects are, not only not true, but, could be harmful.
For listeners right now, in biology, there are different, basically different shapes of molecules. One's a mirror image of a molecule. And when our bodies make stuff, they make one image. And when we make it in a chemistry lab, we get half of them are the natural image and half of them are mirror images. And if you take the mix of those two, it has a different effect than if you use only the natural one. So what Dr. Veach is saying here is that basically you're using a mirror image of a ketone salt that would be helpful, and that's a problem. And for manufacturers like me who make supplements and foods, it is much more expensive to filter out, so you only get the natural ones and you throw away or recycle the ones that are unnatural, even though they might be harmful, they might not be harmful, but they get in the way.
Yeah, well, when you hold up your hands, you're giving the perfect illustration. Those are racemic. Those are racemic. They're mirror images of each other. And the body will use one, but not use the other. Or if it uses the other, it will use it in a pathway which is different than this pathway. And you may get unwanted consequences from using this pathway versus that pathway. So in general, using racemic, it's an extremely rare compound where racemates can be used. The body is very definitely handed.
So your recommendation then, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so tell me if this is exactly the recommendation, is that people don't use ketone salts?
Yes. No, don't use them.
All right. That's
you can't get a high enough levels.
Okay.
And they don't tell you what they are. They don't tell you if it's the D or the L. They just say beta hydroxybutyrate. Well, fine.
Okay.
So the answer is no, those are on sale and you can buy them. And my recommendation is don't touch them with a 10-foot pole.
Okay. I've certainly tried various ones, and I do feel a little bit of energy, but I also feel usually a bit of a headache. And I've seen some studies on liver function that that were concerning. Is that something you pay attention to?
Yes, of course. And we're testing it again, but it's my impression that you could actually precipitate Parkinsonian crises by giving these racemic salts. In other words, you're interfering with the metabolism of the D form. You're interfering the penetration of the D into the brain. They're competing for the monocarboxylate transporter, so you're inhibiting that, and you're also metabolizing the isomeric form through beta oxidation, which is, we go back, reduces Q, which is not what I want to do. I want to oxidize.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty scary on the ketone salt front. If a company came out with one that was only the D form, what would you say?
Well, how high can it get?
You're saying there would just be too much salt and not enough ketone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I hear what you're saying there. So you might get a slight bump, but well, let's talk about salt then, because if you are in ketosis because you're eating, say, like the Bulletproof diet, where since you go into ketosis much of the time, but not all the time, how much extra salt do you actually really need?
Well, you don't need all that much. What you do need is potassium citrate. You need to supplement that because when you're ketotic, you decrease the urinary excretion of uric acid. So if you're in ketosis for quite a while, you can elevate your uric acid and actually precipitate gout. So it would be a good idea if you're ketotic, either from your Bulletproof or any other means,
yep,
that you go to the vitamin shop and buy 50 milligram capsules of potassium citrate and eat those, because that will allow the kidney to excrete the uric acid. So
how much potassium citrate for the average person would you recommend?
Oh, 50 grams, maybe once or twice a day.
Milligrams, right?
Is it milligrams? Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Where's my bottle? All right.
They only sell 99 milligram capsules of
all right, then it's 50 milligrams.
Okay, cool.
Are you sure? Is that right? Yeah, all right. Bill says it's right.
Okay, cool.
So I got a decimal. I slipped.
That happens to me a lot. That's okay. That's a normal science thing. I think that's why the Hubble telescope didn't work the first time. Actually, that was unit conversions, but anyway.
Yeah, well, so, but that's the only salt that I think you need. And the idea that, and not everyone needs it, particularly males who are more subject to gout, so females might not. But you need, if you're going to get ketotic, you need to periodically watch your uric acid.
Yep. And you can do that with a urinary test strip.
Yeah, for uric acid, that's right.
Now, what's your favorite test for ketone levels?
Oh, only the blood tests matter. So you can either, the urine tests are worthless.
Well,
so
why are they worthless? I mean, they're not nearly as accurate, but they're better than nothing, aren't they?
No.
No? I love how blunt you are. Okay, well, why are they not better than nothing?
Because they don't tell you at all what the blood level is. They just tell you how much is in the urine. And one is made by Abbott. It's called Precision Extra.
Yeah, I have that. AccuCheck.
Nova. There's a Nova. And Frank thinks it's good. I've calibrated the precision extra, and it calibrates pretty good down to 0.2 millimolar.
Yeah.
But I and he thinks the other's pretty good. And the other advantage of the second form, the Nova, is it's cheaper.
Oh, I haven't tried that one, but my precision extra one, I literally did this test. And granted, N equals one and not well controlled and all, but I'm a biohacker. Like, how am I doing is the most important thing.
Yeah, so I think you should test that. Absolutely.
I did. So I ate like a pound of sushi with white rice for dinner. Okay, out of ketosis, right? Next morning, empty stomach, fasted, you know, from dinner before. I put 2 tablespoons of brain octane, 1 tablespoon of butter, and I blended up my bulletproof coffee, and I drank it a half hour later, 0.6, right?
And that's very good.
That was enough for me to go, okay, my hunger's turned off, and then the CCK and the ghrelin numbers changed, and that's not nutritional ketosis, though. That's only 0.6. You can go up to 7.0, so I'm at 10% of that, but that much matters for me.
It depends what you're trying to treat.
What are the different levels? Like, what matters?
Well, if you're trying to treat Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. I go to 5.
The higher is better, okay.
If you're trying to treat Parkinson's, I've got a sick guy with 16 years of Parkinson's, and he gets his tremors stop at 0.3.
Wow, that low, 0.3. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's relatively
amazing.
Achievable. I mean, that's... If I can't get someone to 0.3 with the existing stuff on the market, like I'm not very good at what I'm doing.
Oh, that's right. It'll ruin your business, but that's all right.
I'm just saying it's good. Like 0.3 is so easy.
He, in fact, uses the formula which you developed. That's what he used.
Oh, God, it just makes me happy to hear that people are benefiting that way.
He's on maximum Parkinson's med. He's on DOPA, carbidopa, an MAO inhibitor, MCOT inhibitor, and he's here if you want to talk to him.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Come over here, Bill. He's had 16 years of Parkinson's, and when he came to the lab, he called me a year or so ago and said he wanted something. I said, no, I can't do anything. I can't do anything for you. We don't have enough stuff. Go away.
Oh no. Hey Bill.
So he kept coming back, and he'd have to go in the corner of the lab and jump up and down because he'd have spasm and he'd shake like a leaf. And
wow. And you're 16 years with Parkinson's?
Yeah. I'll tell him.
It's been since 2000. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. And you're using all the Parkinson's meds, and you're using mild ketosis or maybe deep ketosis?
I would be in Dr. Veach's lab, and I'd go stand in a corner, jump up and down, try to do anything to get rid of my dystonia, and I had a whole lot of trouble concentrating. I had to have somebody drive me to his lab. Wow. And he got tired of me just having all these symptoms, and he had received an email from Dr. Seyfried. Is that who?
Yes.
And he was saying, you know, if you try this bulletproof coffee recipe with the Kerrygold butter and the cream and the stevia and the coconut oil.
Yeah, the brain octane oil probably, or are you doing just plain coconut oil?
Well, Seyfried sent the recipe with coconut oil.
Okay, got it. So that basically it's a coffee with fat in it. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So I tried that, and I kept track of all of my symptoms, and every hour I would ask myself the question, did I have this symptom in the past hour? And at the end of the first day on that coffee, I looked back, and across about 8 different symptoms, there was only one that it didn't pretty much help thoroughly.
Yeah.
And that was the dyskinesia that's caused by the medicine. And
you're still using that today?
Yes, I have started taking more of the MCT with it.
Let me send you some of the brain octane, because we've got a study that's coming out. It hasn't been published yet, but it appears to do about 3 times to 5 times more ketone production than you'd get from coconut oil or MCTs. So that's why I put it in the official Bulletproof Coffee recipe, because it's like the numbers show there, but I'll send you a bottle of that just to try, because I'm stoked to see anyone who's had Parkinson's for 16 years who's using a higher fat ketosis generating thing. But let me see if I can give you a little boost there.
That's great.
Congratulations on your success. That's amazing. What an incredible incredible outcome. I'm blown away. It's so cool. Let's see. What else was I going to ask you? Okay. Without the ketone ester form that you're working on, and the one that I figured out was $30,000 a pound the way I was trying to make it.
Yeah.
That's why I had one dose of it, because I'm not made out of money, right? What can people do today to raise the ketone levels? Like, what do you recommend if someone comes to you and says, I have a metabolic problem, or I want to be an athlete. How do I get my ketones up?
Well, I probably tell them what I told Bill. Go away. He came to the lab, so I had to. He wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
But what we really need to do is what you said. We need to get production. The problem with recommending a high-fat diet is that certain patients will get increased blood cholesterols, or increased LDL. And the last thing you want to do is precipitate a myocardial infarction, some of these people. For instance, at NIH, you treat epileptics with a high-fat diet. They won't give a high-fat diet to any patient over 17 years of age, and they won't do it for fear of cardiac complications.
It seems a bit ridiculous given some of the newer science coming out. I mean, Mark Hyman, the Cleveland Clinic, there's so many big things coming out saying it depends on the kind of fat, depends on what else is in the fat. Is the fat damaged?
I can send you the paper from Johns Hopkins from Kredovich, and that's the Mayo diet, and it says that you elevate the cholesterol, and when the cardiologists hear that, you quote all the papers you want to. They don't want to hear you.
Yeah, they don't want to hear you. But the newer papers are saying that cholesterol is not what they thought it was, right?
Well, I could agree with that, but I would simply say that you don't want to willy-nilly raise people's ketones by fat without keeping an eye on their blood lipids.
And their inflammation too, right?
That's right. And so, the current the country runs on statins.
Yep.
That's you're not going to change that. And so, cholesterol is a bad thing, whether it actually is or not.
What I found is that when people go on the specific bulletproof diet, which is a set of protocols, it's not a product-based thing, it's a lifestyle, that they're increasing specific kinds of fat, but not all fats, and they're avoiding canola, they're avoiding the omega-6s that cause arachidonic acid and other inflammatory things, and they're not deep-frying anything the way Atkins would have allowed, so you're not getting damaged fats. And when they do that, and they avoid certain other inflammatory compounds in foods, mostly basically protective elements in plants that are hard on us, that their cholesterol levels may go up, they may stay the same, they may go down, but very predictably, triglycerides plummet when you do this. You're not eating fructose, so triglycerides go down. That's pretty easy to understand. But the markers that I pay the most attention to, homocysteine, C-reactive protein, and LPPLA2, which is a marker of damage to the arteries, those guys drop. And if they don't, we have a methylation problem that you can address with other things. But so in the majority of people, like, that's what I expect to see. And if you're not doing your labs, you have no idea what your fat's doing to you. You have no idea if the diet's working. But if you do your labs, where the problem is now, if inflammation is most important, we dropped inflammation, everybody wins. But if cholesterol is most important, if it did go up, if you're one of those people where it does go up and stay up, a lot of people goes up then drops. But okay, then what do you do? Well, my inflammation just dropped, my cholesterol's up. Which one's most important? In my world, inflammation's most important. And if I can't see any damage to my arteries, then I'm probably not going to have a myocardial infarction. But man, there's debate about this. It's very fair to say. That's a framework.
Well, your problem is you know too much biochemistry, and the doctors do just certain tests, and they don't think about all homocysteine. You're not preaching to the choir, you're preaching to a band. All the things you mentioned about inflammation and these C-reactive protein are, of course, extremely important, but those aren't what Merck
No, they're not mainstream.
Makes money selling statins.
Yeah.
And they push statins forever.
It's true. And I what I'm looking at is I'm, because the Bulletproof Diet has sold a couple hundred thousand copies and it's in four languages, I feel very solid in my science. I live this stuff. My wife, my kids, my whole family, like we all do this, and I track the numbers and I believe it, right? But I don't want to be self-deceptively believing anything. So anytime I get a chance to talk with someone who, after you worked with Krebs, if you poke holes in that theory, I'll tell people about those holes because I believe it's really important. And we can do this without drugs, and we can use drugs selectively. Drugs are not a bad thing. They can save lives. They have saved lives. They've also taken lives, just like food poisoning has taken lives. Like food isn't good or bad because some people die from it. But I don't want us using drugs when we should be using food. And it's just a bias.
Certain things you can do only with, I don't call them foods, I call them substrates.
Yeah.
There are certain substrates that are essential. And it's not easy. I don't know of a way I could make those changes in mitochondrial energy production by using pharmacologic agents. I can only do it by changing substrates.
Well, in my world as someone who had, I believe, mitochondrial damage and a lot of metabolic dysregulation and inflammation and just autoimmune conditions, Lyme disease, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, all those things I've had, mercury poisoning, and to be sitting here today, I do everything that I can find in a paper that says it's going to increase my mitochondrial function. I do infrared light stimulation, UV exposure, all sorts of weird stuff, cryotherapy. Basically, I stack everything in my favor because I plan to live a long time and I like to feel good. But but very few people do that. And I have to say, the number one thing that's made the biggest difference in my energy is getting my ketone levels up, not up to 7. I've only done that a few times, but just up. And I'm also not treating one of the diseases that you're treating with that stuff. I'm just looking for it. But you gave me the number. That the number is 28%. I think earlier we were saying 38, but
that's right.
It's 28%.
But yeah, that's right.
And I do, now that I hear that number, I remember looking something about number of electrons. This goes way back into the early days of what I was reading about. Something about just the number of the amount of calories per gram of fat versus calories per gram of carbs. You're going to eat a gram of something, there is more energy in fat. But what you're saying is from ketones specifically, there's a different effect that's 28%.
Well, when you eat fat, it's true. Diesel oil has more calories per gram than sugar.
Yep.
However, when you're burning fat, you're going through beta oxidation. So one reducing equivalent goes to NAD and one goes to flavoprotein. So you've already lost one third of your ATP in that step. Go back to your Leninger.
Okay.
And beta oxidation, you do one NADH, you do one flavoprotein. And you do that to keep from blowing the mitochondria up.
Right. As in physically blowing it up, right?
Well, I just like too much energy.
Right.
You're running. You're running the voltage across your mitochondrial membrane for four electrons is about 140 to 160 millivolts. If you got it up to 180, you'd hear a bunch of pops like popping a condenser. You can't put that much voltage across the mitochondria. It's only a lipoprotein membrane. You can't put that much voltage across it. It'll blow up.
It's kind of like a car. If you're running nitrous oxide in a drag car, you're going to blow a gasket somewhere.
That's right.
Is there a risk of this? This is something I've asked myself when I go to sleep at night, and I don't actually spend any time worrying. I've hacked that. But I think about stuff, and if I've maximized my mitochondrial function so they burn cleanly, and I've basically moved the ratios so that I'm making the most energy I can, one perspective is that I'm going to wear them out. And the other one is, and the one I favor, but I don't have great data on this, is that I'm less likely to get cancer if my mitochondria are running at maximum capacity, and I'll probably live longer. Am I making a fundamental error there?
I don't think so.
Okay, I appreciate your perspective on that because some of this is unknown. I don't know anyone who's spent 40 or 100 years of their life in mild ketosis pretty much every single day, but that's what I'm going to be doing. I've been doing it for the last 10 years. I'm not stopping.
Frank, who you talked to, he is quite interested in making himself ketotic, and he can give...
Who is this? I must have missed the one before that.
Frank Yosa, you've spoken to him, okay. One of your assistants has, and he can get ketone levels of up to 8. temperature is, that's high enough.
He can get up to 8, and he's doing that just with fat, or how's he doing that? Hey, Frank.
Frank.
So my family's vegan, and we don't need to go into the debate on
there's no need, vegan or not. There's no need to debate.
I used Bulletproof C8 in the morning. So I was experimenting with different amounts of MCT8 with coconut oil, seeing how high I could go, and seeing if doing it after an overnight fast. And I was down in the, you know, the 1 and the 2s, and he was freaking out, like, how are you able to do that? But I kept on tweaking it. And the other day, I sent him a message saying, hey, my keto meter has something nice it wants to say. Hi. We maxed it out. Ate, and he goes, go eat an apple. So I ate half of a pear to bring it back down, but I hit high twice. But I've been, right now, I'm probably like 5.5, and it's on a vegan diet, so it can be done. And it's not a ketogenic diet either. It's just...
So you're not doing a low carb, so you're eating some rice and stuff.
I'm absolutely doing low carbs. So I'm doing
lots of green vegetables and lots of brain octane, basically.
I'm just removing bread, pasta, chips, those basic ones that are oftentimes a staple, just off the table. And then just a lot of avocado, macadamia nuts, walnuts, a lot of nuts. Coconut flakes is my favorite thing at night. If I really need something, it's got the crunch. But I'm still eating hummus.
Wow.
Black beans. Yeah.
I can get some carbs. Okay.
If I get a chip and I have to do a huge hummus on it. Yeah. So the hummus, is still in there.
You make the hummus yourself with brain octane in it or no?
No, I do. So my first experiment was just the morning and then checking my levels at different intervals afterward. But then now I've started to actually incorporate just a squirt of it at lunch, just a squirt of it at dinner time. And I used to be conked out. I put the kids to bed at 8 p.m. and you lay down with them and it's like, I'm out. And then it messes up my entire sleep. But then, with playing with the MCT, it's been a noticeable difference. I'm not conked out at 9 o'clock.
There are more than a few vegans using brain octane. I was a raw vegan for a while. And by the way, people think I hate on vegans. I don't. I've been a vegan. I want to not kill animals. I just want healthy soil and all that stuff. But yeah, if you're going to be a vegan, I think having some ketosis involved, like masses of avocados and macadamias, and that was actually a lot of what I did when I was a raw vegan. I wasn't fully ketosis, but I was like, I'm going to die if I don't get fat, because my metabolism was wrecked. So it's amazing that you've hit 8. You're the highest ketone vegan that I've met so far. And
the one trick that I found was, because obviously there's a GI problem with the MCT8. If you take a little bit too much, I've been able to get up to 4 tablespoons at one time with a 1 tablespoon of coconut, and I found that the moment, exactly 22 minutes later, I feel a twinge in my stomach, I take 5 macadamia nuts and it goes away.
The reason that I recommend not blending just brain octane in coffee is that it causes GI distress. If you put another fat with it, it solves the problem, and butter is the other fat. Yeah.
I did the 4 MC, well, we can't do the butter because of the vegan.
That's right.
So I did the 4 C8 and 1 coconut oil. So that was a little bit of the longer. And then the macadamia nut 22 minutes later, the moment that I start, because otherwise I was running to the bathroom and it's, who can get to the bathroom faster? And
4 tablespoons of brain octane is a lot. The reason...
I'm now down to 1 and 2. Okay. 1 or 2 now. And I just got... He made me get my cholesterol levels. He kept on yelling at me. He's like, get your cholesterol checked. And it just came back 105.
105? That's like a little too low. Do you have any testosterone in there?
Of the LDL.
Oh, of LDL. One, okay, cool. That wasn't total. I was like, man, you're going to die. Okay.
No. So...
Wow. Well, congratulations. You're doing something right. And one thing about the brain octane versus MCT, MCTs, especially the 10... is very disaster pants promoting. And when you get to just the 8, you can tolerate a lot more of that and you get more ketones per unit. So the increased bowel tolerance and the increased ketone levels equals, okay, that's why it's in there. I would tell people just use coconut oil if it worked.
Yeah,
right?
The C8 is more expensive, but if you're actually breaking it down like per ketone, it's probably cheaper.
It is cheaper per ketone.
You have to take 2 to 3 times as much. Yeah.
And I get all pissed off when people are selling lauric acid as an MCT because it doesn't actually raise ketones the way actual biological MCTs do. But that's a whole nother debate. So,
All right. I'd just like to say one thing that I wouldn't like a lot of what Frank's. Frank is smarter than the average brown bear. and he also talks to me once every day or two, and he monitors his level. For the general public, what he's doing is probably not to be recommended.
It's on the outer edge of experimentation.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, I watch him. I don't think there's any hear himself, but I wouldn't want that to be put out as a general.
No, as a general.
The safer thing is use the get the ketone esters made. That you can regulate them. You can eat what you want. He has a very extreme diet, and he also knows a lot. Well, yeah. And he follows his diet, so it's I wouldn't recommend what he. It works. He's shown me a lot of things I didn't believe could happen, but I wouldn't want to recommend it.
There's a role for biohacking where you're like, okay, this is my belief system. These are my goals. And different people have different goals. And if your goal is, I don't want to ever kill another animal, you got to make sure that all the vegetables that you ate didn't kill animals in their production, which is a harder thing to do. But okay, let's say that's your goal. So then you pursue that goal and you look at all the biological and metabolic effects, and we might learn something new from that. And I support that 100%, but I also wonder if we're right now probably between a quarter and a half a million people are going to hear this conversation, and I would be bothered if a lot of them said, I'm going to go on a essentially high fat vegan diet right now because it's the way to raise my ketones. There are many ways to raise your ketones, and I'm not sure that I'd recommend that as the most anti-aging, long-term, least inflammatory, most studied way to do it, but here's an example of someone who pulled it off, right? That's cool.
Remember, the first rule of a doctor is do no harm. So I really don't want to kill patients. As I tell my students, I don't mind killing the administrators, but I have problem killing patients. So I think that a little Frank is a bit extreme in what he's doing. He can do it, but I don't know anyone else. I've never seen anyone else do it. Let's put it that way.
I've not heard of someone hitting those levels, especially with carbs present. But it's cool. He's got some tools. He's working on it. Now, we're coming up on the end of the interview. I feel like I could talk to you for another hour. But there's a question I want to ask you. And you might have some of the most interesting answers of anyone I've interviewed, because I've asked every guest on the show this. And given all the things you've learned in your life, not just science, but all the things you've learned, if someone came into your office tomorrow and said, Dr. Veach, I want to perform better at everything I do as a human being. Like I want to kick more ass at life. What are the three most important pieces of advice you have for me? What would you say?
Well, number one, keep your weight down. Don't get overweight. Two, exercise. In moderation. And I think the third thing is to enjoy yourself. I think a healthy attitude is a very desirable thing. Now, I think in the long run, maybe we'll come back in a little while and say we should perhaps be ketotic, but we don't have that evidence yet. And so that's for another edition.
I love it that being ketotic wasn't one of your top three. That's really cool.
No. I mean, it's very important, but it has not been established that long and happy life results in ketosis. It may be true, but we have not shown that yet.
I will do my best to show an N equals one example of that, because I feel so crappy when I'm not in mild ketosis that I'm not willing to go there.
Yes. Well, of course, the starvation, caloric restriction was very popular. And the man that, I forget his name, but he was in California, died.
It wasn't Bill Falloon. He's still alive, right?
Oh, no, I forget his name, but he died at about 72. So it didn't work. And but as I said, if you look at some effects of ketone ester on cholesterol, on blood sugar, on inflammation, on energy, on cerebral function, and general strength, you're talking about many of the hallmarks of the phenotypes of the aging thing, and particularly the free radical.
This is profound stuff. I've had an amazing time. I've learned a couple things I didn't know about, particularly around the salt levels and ketone salts, and around the radioactive free radical protective effects of ketones in the body, particularly around radiation. These are things that I just didn't know about. And God, I feel like I read all the papers, but there you go. You actually do read all the papers then. So thanks for your work, Dr. Veach. You know, 47 years of looking at this is remarkable. Is there something new on the horizon after ketone esters? Like, what's next for you?
Right now, our main problem is to get them produced in quantity at a low price.
Well, I will support you on that. We're going to have a conversation afterwards about that and see if there's something I can do to move the needle for you. And thanks again for your work. And I look forward to having you on the show again in maybe a year or so when you made some progress.
Okay, thank you very much.
If you enjoyed today's show, you know what to do. Like, send it to a friend. Go on to iTunes and click like, or give it a good review, or whatever it is you do on iTunes. I forget there. Or better yet, if you want to actually see what Dr. Veach looks like and experience the video of this, head on over to bulletproofexec.com/YouTube, and we'll hook you up with our YouTube channel. So I'll let you know every time one of these things comes out on YouTube. I appreciate you listening, and while you're at it, pick up an extra bottle of Brain Octane and some Bulletproof coffee beans, put it in your morning coffee, pour Brain Octane on your sushi the way I do, it tastes pretty good, and just get your ketones up a little bit. You might feel different if you do it, I'm just saying. Have an awesome day.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.